So today we're going to talk finally, we're going to talk about the Andrew effect and we're going to talk about thermality. Thermality is a very tricky notion. Thermality is easy when you have systems of finite dimension. Thermality is not easy when you have infinite dimensional systems. Well, not all infinite dimensional systems, but infinitely many as in a non-countable kind of way, dimensional system. So today we're going to talk, I'm going to give you like, it's going to be three slides or so with the original derivation of the Andrew effect. And then we're going to talk about it a little bit. And then we're going to go back to we're going to do the second derivation of the Andrew effect. A more modern view than the first paper, I guess. And we're going to talk about what thermality means first. So today is going to be about what the heck do we mean when we talk about thermality? What's a thermal state? Okay. We're going to discuss that a little bit. All right, so the Andrew effect. Original derivation, very summarized, okay? Imagine that I have flat space-time, and I have a quantum scalar quantum field, massless scalar quantum field, massless real scalar quantum field, living in that background, okay? And then I have an observer, Alice, that's inertial, living in that background, and then Alice sees the field, and can actually get to know what the field is like. To do that, get Klein-Gordon equation, and then basically solves that and gets a complete set of solutions of that equation, basically kind of proportional to plane waves. This is not plane waves, this is the temporal part. So stationary solutions, that's gonna be the form of plane waves, for example. I mean, it could be any form, spatially. If you prefer, so spherical harmonics, although this is one dimension also, not really, but anyway. This is a complete set of solutions that you label with a frequency omega. I put a hat there that doesn't mean an operator or anything, it's just a number omega, okay? And then nice, doing that, she's got a complete basis, so she can do a second quantization procedure on the general solution of that equation. So get the field, get the general solution expressed as coefficients times the elements of the basis, and those coefficients, you assign them B such that, now B operators, and B such that you satisfy canonical commutation relationships between phi and pi. We call that canonical quantization. Okay, she can do it. That's textbook. She got a book, one of those books that don't care too much about, that they're very computational. Those books that give you a recipe how to do it, get Peskin. Then get Peskin and do scalar theory there. Alice can do it. Now imagine another observer that follows an accelerated trajectory, all right? Say that it's got those coordinates, okay? The coordinates psi and tau. Now, Rob, this accelerated observer, of course, can also have a copy of Peskin and lives in a space-time that is flat, and there is a scalar field, so Klein-Gordon equation still applies, and Peskin wants to try to solve the Klein-Gordon equation in his own proper reference frame, coordinates psi and tau. Now, there's a little problem. And the little problem is that the coordinates t and xi do not cover the whole of spacetime. Those things, those coordinates, are supported only on the right wedge. So, not quite. They can cover fully the right wedge. They cannot cover, the right way to say, they cannot cover the left wedge. Okay? They're not defined here, those coordinates. Now, that's a bit of a problem. Because my quantum field theory lives in the whole spacetime. So if I want to quantize the full theory, I can do it in the whole spacetime. But Rob would argue, hold on, I see a whole spacetime, meaning that my time can go to infinity and my space can go to infinity. I can do this and I see infinite. Okay? So Rob sees a flat spacetime in his own right. So Rob is allowed to do a quantum field theory. Well, Rob solves the equations of motion, solves the Klein-Gordon equation in his own frame, and find kind of plane wave-like solutions, but stationary with respect to this time tau. I mean, you require really huge accelerations for this to be cataclysmic, so I don't know what's going on. All right. They're moving something, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, so Rob solves the Klein-Gordon equations and finds something that is proportional, if you want, to these kind of terms with something stationary with respect to time tau. Now, the problem is that this is not a complete basis of solutions for the field in the whole space-time. It would be only a complete set of solutions wherever those coordinates are defined. So that's not enough to do a full field quantization in the whole space-time. Maybe we can add something else. Maybe we can add another accelerated observer following the complementary negative acceleration. Okay? So if we have that, we have another observer. Now that observer has coordinates that cover this patch, not the right patch, but the left one. And therefore that person can do a field quantization here that will not cover the field that he solves. Is not the modes that he finds are not supported everywhere, but they are supported in the left wedge. Now Rob has modes that are supported in the right wedge. They're both complete set of solutions in their own wedges, in their own their space times that they see. And if we use solutions to the equation for Bob and for Rob and for anti-Rob, right, the wedge too, we have again a complete basis that can span the field in the whole spacetime. So if we desire so now, we can write a field. This sum represents sum over modes, so it's an integral in general. So we have the field, of course, expanded in the usual way in terms of Minkowski plane waves, for example, a set of solutions in the whole spacetime. Or equivalently, and that's an equal sign, we can write it expanded in terms of a different complete basis of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equations, composed of a complete basis in the wedge one and a complete basis in the wedge two. That's enough, because we do have a Cauchy surface that is fully containing one and two. So that's fine. We can write the field like that. All right, so we can write an equal sign between the two. Now, as you see, maybe you don't see it, but let me tell you, these two quantization procedures are what they call non-unitarily equivalent. That meaning, if I now want to write A, the annihilation operator of modes type one in the Rindler quantization in terms of AMs and A dagger Ms, they're going to mix up the A daggers and the A's. The transformation between the two, well, you take, it's very easy to compute. Maybe we can do it in this free tutorial that we have. It's easy. You take inner products with the modes on the left. And because of the orthonormality relationship with the Klein-Gordon product, you just select a mode here in Minkowski. You do the same here, and you end up with inner products of Rindler modes with Minkowski modes. And they are non-zero, all of them. So you get that the annihilation operators don't map to combinations of annihilation operators. They map to combinations of creation and annihilation operators. That means that the two quantization schemes define a different vacuum. Remember, the vacuum is annihilated by the annihilation operators. Now, if in one quantization you mix the creation and annihilation operators together, the vacuum is not going to be the same as in the other quantization. Okay? So they have different vacua, these two quantization schemes. That's what we mean when we say non-unitarily equivalent, all right? Which I summarize as the change of basis is non-trivial. Fine. So we can ask, for example, right, so they don't have the same vacuum. So what does the vacuum, and it's a very easy vacuum here, which is the vacuum associated with the time-like killing vector, partial t. So, okay, we have a Minkowskian vacuum. What does it look like if we express this in the basis that Rob and anti-Rob construct together? If we do that, without calculations for this one, but trust me, that's what you get. It's not difficult to compute again. We can go over it in a little bit in a tutorial if you want. Change of Fock basis. We change from the Fock basis that comes from the Minkowskian quantization to the Rindler quantization. And what you get is something like this. Now, that state, as you see, the vacuum state Minkowski mixes excitations, if you want, living in wedge one and in wedge two. And not any kind of way, right? So this mix-up is funny. I mean, in terms of, is it an interesting quantum state, I would ask. Does anyone recognize that state? It's got a name. In quantum optics, that state's got a name. Who knows it? That state is called a two-mode squeezed state. All right? So that is a two-mode squeezed state. And you can trace out the, so okay, from that, of course, that's not what Rob would see. If we want to ask, what does Rob see? Well, Rob doesn't see the whole state because Rob lives accelerating forever, lives in wedge one, has no access to modes that live in wedge two. It's space-like separated from wedge two. So he cannot cannot access any information on wedge two. So he needs to, the most complete description he's got about his state has to come after tracing out over all possible states in two, tracing out the part living in the wedge two. Now, interestingly, that state is entangled. It's an entangled, it's non-separable. A two-mode squeeze state is non-separable. So when we trace out, we're not going to get a pure state. Rob is not going to see a pure state. In fact, he's going to see something like that. filtration app. Maybe you recognize that already, because that looks a lot like a thermostat, kind of. In fact, if we compute the expectation value of Rindler excitations on the right weight, what we get is something like this, a Bose-Einstein distribution, and the temperature associated with that distribution is this thing here. You can associate a temperature. Well, if you just think, oh, that looks a lot like, this is very naive yet. We haven't done things very rigorously yet. So this is true, when you get something like that, and then you say, well, it looks a lot like a thermal state. That thermal state, if you actually expand this R in terms of the acceleration parameters above an anti-rob, you get that the counting of particles at a frequency, at a Rindler frequency omega, is something that looks like a Bose-Einstein distribution. And then you say, well, if this is a Bose-Einstein distribution, then the temperature is something like this. This temperature is proportional to the acceleration, and this is what Andrew called, he never called it the Andrew effect. We call it the Andrew effect. I don't know, he called it like this. In talks, he always says, this phenomenon that you see particles when you accelerate. So, a temperature proportional to the acceleration, we call it the Andrew temperature. And this is the very rough summary of the first derivation of the Andrew effect, basically saying, so you have Alice in an inertial frame. So Alice is free falling if you want. And then you have an accelerated frame. Alice observes the field vacuum, whereas Bob observes a thermal bath, you would say, of temperature proportional to the acceleration. This is the classical, the first derivation of the Andrew effect. That's the one you would see in textbooks too. Not all textbooks, textbooks that don't talk about detectors. Any questions about this? All right. It's kind of cool because you say, oh yeah, the vacuum, the ground state is observer dependent. What someone calls the vacuum, I'm not talking curved spacetimes yet here. I have a flat spacetime, but I have one observer that has a four velocity partial t, an inertial observer, and another observer that has a four velocity partial tau, corresponding to the boost generator. The partial tau is the proper time of an accelerated observer. And that observer doesn't, when Alice sees the vacuum, Bob seems to see particles. In that way that we define it as, you know, sees a non-zero expectation of the number operator. Alice is like, it's the ground state, Bob would be, ooh, no, it's a thermal state. Not temperature zero, a finite temperature thermal state. All right? Now, this derivation has problems. Problem number one, I mean, an easy one, right? To derive this, we needed to assume a trajectory of an accelerated observer that is accelerating forever. We did kind of a statistical counting of all the information that Rob has access everywhere. So you require infinite time acceleration, accelerating forever. Now, that's arguably very little physical. I mean, things don't accelerate forever. Also, maybe it travels, because what happens if you stop the acceleration in the middle? You cannot do this derivation. This derivation falls. Maybe the effect's still there. This derivation falls. And if the effect actually fell, that would be disturbing, because that would mean that someone who's accelerating goes and measures the state of the field, sees thermality of some kind, and then says, damn it, I'm going to be accelerating forever. I will never stop, because otherwise the derivation would fall. Well, those things were argued against this, but there's one fundamental criticism we can have. Is this enough to talk about thermality? So I just did a couple of transformations. It's interesting, two quantization schemes that are not unitarily equivalent, all right? And it seems that the partial state of Rob sounds like something thermal, as in like the expectation of the number operator is Bose-Einstein. Is that enough to talk about thermality? But that's the next thing we're going to discuss. Any questions? I hope that I can turn it off. Yeah.
So one of the arguments against this particular derivation of the Andrew effect was that you can distinguish between an infinitely forever accelerated observer and
a finite
observer who stops accelerating at some point.
It's one of the arguments, but that argument is not. So can we have light, maybe? I don't know how to control. Oh, thank you. Thank you. So that's one argument, but keep in mind, the only thing that you cannot do is this derivation. Maybe the effect's still there. If you have a finite acceleration, you could argue, well, you accelerate long enough.
I can see that the argument specifically indicates that, because you shouldn't be able to tell difference between the two, that the argument would be, in fact, that it does work for a finite time.
So people would ask it, would be asking, oh, Andrew, come up with a finite time acceleration derivation for it. Okay? He did, though. He did in a much better way than this. All right. So to understand this, to understand all these questions, we need to understand thermality first. So what is a thermal state, really? Is it just having a particle count that is Bose-Einstein? So particle counts are, we discussed a little bit, and there's going to be exercise that you will do, that kind of counting particles and expectation of the number operator could be misleading, highly. And also particles, that those things are delocalized and live everywhere. Huh? This is kind of particles. That's not very physical. It's not a very nice way to define thermality. But there's a bigger problem. What is a thermal state? Well, who can tell me what a thermal state is? I know you know. We owe that definition to Gibbs. How did Gibbs define? Yeah.
State of maximum entropy.
There you go. At a given energy, the state of maximum entropy. Quantumly, if we go for Neumann, it would be at a fixed expectation value of energy, the state of maximum entropy. Those are thermal states. So max entropy at constant what? Energy. Now we have a problem though, because here we have a quantum field. Now say that I give you, expectation value of energy E. What's the maximum entropy that the quantum field can have? Anyone knows? If we limit energy, what's the maximum entropy that's compatible with a given energy in a field? I mean, people can say, if you want to say it properly, we say it's not well-defined. It's not well-defined as a von Neumann entropy. It's not really well-defined. People could say, well, infinite, because it's an infinite dimensional system. You have infinite degeneracy. You can get modes arbitrarily close to any other mode. So at a given energy, the entropy will diverge, the maximum entropy possible is divergent. A little bit more concrete, the partition function is divergent. So you cannot use Gibbs' definition for a thermal state. A question you may have, if you're in a cavity, you're fine with Gibbs. If you're in free space, you cannot. So you have a free field, no cavities or anything. The Gibbs condition for thermality is ill-defined for a quantum field. And in general, for an infinitely many uncountable number of dimensions of a quantum system. So that's a problem. We don't have a notion of Gibbs thermality in a quantum field theory. So what can we do, or what did people do? Have you ever heard about the KMS condition? That's what we're going to do. Let me just get this just in case. So pictures on my whiteboards, in case I forget. All right, so people realize Martin and Swinger on one hand, and Kubo, I guess, on the other hand, it's Japanese. How do you pronounce it? It's K-U-B-O?
I mean, roughly how you said it, yeah.
Something like Kubo. It's not Kubo. It's definitely something like Kubo. Kubo-san, I guess, the name of the person. So Martin and Swinger on one hand, and Kubo on the other hand, they figure out an interesting condition that is satisfied by thermostates that implies a bunch of things that thermostates have. It's almost one-to-one to thermostates. As in, like, when I can define a Gibbs state, that's well-defined, it's got the right limits, it's also passive, and also survives the kind of limit that takes me to infinite dimension. That's called the Kubo-Martin-Schwinger condition. Let's look at it. Which is what we call KMS. All right. So that's kind of cool because it associates the correlations in a quantum system with its thermality. Basically saying a thermal state is a state that has a particular kind of correlations. And it's kind of cool. And it's based on this nice observation that thermality or thermal states kind of look like imaginary time evolved states, right? Because they are exponentials of minus beta Hamiltonian. So if you think of imaginary time, that's the kind of, it would be equivalent to something that some unitary operation, no longer unitary when you do that, but some unitary operation, but it's no longer some unitary evolution, but instead of having unitary evolution, I substitute my time by some imaginary time. And then I get something like thermal. So it's kind of related to that connection, as we will see. And it's basically saying, look, when we have a thermal state, we have a particular property, that seems to be almost one-to-one to thermality on the correlations of the system, in particular on the two-point correlations of the system. And let me write it. So let me define what to call this, because I want to use C for commutators. Correlations, commutators. I don't know. Funny C for correlations. The two-point correlator of a quantum system in a thermal state. So let me just, let's compute. The two-point correlator of a quantum system of an observable in a thermal state. So assumption, thermal state as in Gibbs. Assumption, the Gibbs state is well defined. To do this game, let's just find what the two-point correlator of a thermal state is when thermal states can be defined as Gibbs state. Okay? That's it. Yeah.
I thought they were...
Quantum fields. I didn't say fields.
Okay.
A quantum system. So we're gonna first, when we know what thermality is, because Gibbs and von Neumann told us, let's find a cool property that all thermal states have, that is almost one-to-one to it. Okay, that's what we're gonna find.
What are we finding the two-point correlator of if it's not a quantum field?
Two-point correlator is just the expectation value of the observable evaluated at two different coordinates. We will see. I'm gonna define it. Say the observable A in a thermal state. Now, thermal states are also stationary. You know that? Meaning that they are fixed points of evolution. So thermal state, if I have, it's not moving anymore at all. Not even assisted. Well, I hope I didn't break it or anything, but that works. All right, so, so we have an observable A. Let's talk about evolution. I mean, let's figure out, we're gonna compute traces anyways, but let's figure out the evolution. Let's write the evolution in the Heisenberg picture. So I have A of T, right? It's equal to, let's say I have some Hamiltonian, for simplicity, not time dependent. Let me just take the same signs as here. Minus HT A of 0 e to the I H tau prime. Tau. All right. Let's have this observable that depends on time. Okay. And now let's compute the two-point correlator in a thermal state of that observable. So the two-point correlator C at a time t prime is going to be the expectation value of, in a thermal state, say that this is a thermal state of inverse temperature beta, of at prime. So that's the two-point correlator. That's what I mean by the two-point correlator. So that two-point correlator at different times, so how the observable A correlates with itself at a different time. Because thermal states are stationary, so using stationarity, that means invariance under time translations. If I translate T and T prime by the same amount, it is the same. That's one of the properties of a Gibbs equilibrium. To begin with, to be thermal is a necessary condition to be stationary. So using stationarity, I get TR, TR is trace, rho beta, A delta T, A of 0. I just translated the whole thing, so T prime is 0. And delta T is T minus T prime. All right. Now, this is a thermal state, and it's a Gibbs thermal state. So because a Gibbs thermal state exists, I can write this as 1 over the partition function, and then trace of E to the minus beta Hamiltonian. I should have, because I'm writing hats everywhere when I remember it, I should add everything. All right. And then I write this minus I H delta T. All right. Yes. A zero E to the I H delta T. A zero trace. Okay. Well, I can write this, of course. If I'm, I can leave it like that. That's fine. Yeah, I think that's fine. All right. So this is the two-point correlator of an observable A at two different times, T and T prime. Assuming that the state of the system that has the observable A as an observable is thermal, as in Gibbs thermal. Questions? Everyone following? Okay. Now, this is, because it's stationary, let me collect it here. C of delta tau. For thermal states, we can write only depends on delta tau, is translationally invariant. Remember, that comes from stationary. Okay. This thing I got, that is 1 over the partition function, trace of e to the minus beta h, e to the I h delta t, square minus. Okay, that's so important, the signs here. That's why I'm trying to be careful. E to the I h delta t, a zero. That's the result we got. All right, that's the two-point correlator. Now, let's find out, so temperature kind of, remember this connection with imaginary time kind of thing? Why don't we try to compute the correlator, plus or minus, important, with a plus. Evaluated at a time, delta time plus I beta. Of course, if you are fully rigorous, what you mean is, what is the value of the analytical continuation to the complex plane of the correlator? Because an expectation value is supposed to be real. But I'm evaluating it now the variable in the complex plane. This thing has nice analytical extension, so everything's fine. All the things here assume. I'm assuming that the Hamiltonian is all well-defined. It's a Gibbs. It's guaranteed by the existence of a Gibbs state anyways. All these things are well-defined mathematically. If you have doubts about it, we can talk about it later. But let's evaluate, and if we were just doing physics, no mathematical physics, we wouldn't care. We'd say, oh, let's evaluate it at that time, okay? So what do we get? I guess the physics way of doing things is, let's assume it exists. What would be the result if that's the case? All right, so let's compute it. Let's evaluate it. That's 1 over set trace of E to the, oh, what am I doing? I think I copied the wrong signs here. Ech. All right. Anyway, so let me just do it from here. I have the result for delta tau. Let's substitute delta tau. Let's substitute delta tau by I beta. Okay? So in that case, if I substitute delta tau with I beta, let me just put this together. This beta here would be, let me just write this as 1 over set trace of E to the minus IH. And then I get delta T minus I beta. What? Why do I have a minus there? Yeah, that's because I did something wrong. With this periodicity with the plus, I have to do it like this, which is fine, it's a convention. Okay, it's because of the notation that I took. I got the wrong one in the board. Apologies, but it's easily fixable. So let me just take the time evolution like this. All right, this is just a convention, so nothing happens really. Let me do this and that. So that way I have with a plus, minus beta, I beta. I times I is negative. No, it's a plus. I'm so sorry. I got it wrong. I'm really sorry when this happens. All right. My bad. And this is so frustrating for everyone. And I know. Okay, so plus, minus. Now would be minus plus. All right. Is that right? Yes, it's right, no? I minus and minus and minus. I get minus beta out of it. Yeah. It's all right. My bad, sorry. The moment that I rely on something and that something is wrong, that happens. And I know, I've been there and I know how frustrating it is. All right, so that is correct. A, zero, then e to the I, h, delta t, a, zero. All right, so in that expression, let's substitute delta t by delta t plus I beta, which is nice because it cancels this. That's what I wanted, and that's why I was like worried about it. All right, so that means that this is going to be minus I h delta t here, and then I get a of zero, a of I h delta t plus I beta. Just evaluating the last expression in delta t plus I beta. Good. But this, using the properties of the trace, is just e to the, so I can move this here. I can, so a zero, I'm missing an a zero, that's why. Again, big scare. A zero there. So using the properties of the trace, I can write this as a zero, e to the minus I h delta t. Then a zero again, e to the I h delta t plus I beta. Interesting. But I can keep using the properties of the trace. And right now, trace of e to the I h delta t plus I beta. So the exponential of I beta, I took it to the other side of the trace. A zero, e to the minus I h delta t, a zero. And interesting enough, that thing, I can undo the product and write 1 over z trace of exponential of minus beta h, exponential of I h delta t, a zero. Look at how nice this is. Minus I h delta t. This is the kind of result that makes you love physics. You get that. Let's compare this and that. What is it? Are they similar? They are pretty similar, aren't they? I mean, if you want to get fancy, just call the whole thing rho. Because this thing times this thing is rho beta, is the thermal state. But for the comparison, we don't need to. This thing and that thing are related by a simple transformation, which is what?
Time reversal.
Say again?
Time reversal.
That's right. So this thing is the correlator evaluated at minus delta tau. So the correlator, the two-point correlator of any observable, just look at this. I didn't tell you what observable it was. Any observable of a thermal state in a system that you can define a Gibbs state has the nice property that the two-point correlator, it's always periodic in imaginary temperature, in imaginary parameter, anti-periodic, because you get a minus delta tau. You get what I mean? This thing is what we call complex periodicity. Anti-periodicity. And that's a universal property of thermal states. That is interesting in its own right, because it's saying thermal states have a particular kind of correlations in all their observables. When you thermalize, all your observables will be correlated in the same way. Like this. That's a So question, is that one-to-one? Is that a definition of thermality too? Almost. For finite, so when a Gibbs state can be well defined, then yes. So it's one-to-one. So all Gibbs, not quite. All Gibbs states are KMS. Not all KMS are Gibbs states, but almost. You need to find really, really ill KMS states for them to not to be thermal. Has to do with the Hamiltonian not being well defined and things like that. Yeah, go for it.
Is there any like physical interpretation of that?
Yeah, well, again, the physical interpretations come from a lot of hand waving. And this is related to the fact that, no, it is. I mean, if you do a weak rotation, then you can interpret the thermality. So what is thermality is time evolution. So it's basically telling you, yeah, you can interpret thermality as time evolution with imaginary time. That's kind of the physics behind it, if you want. As much as you want to call imaginary time evolution physics, that's a matter of choice. Okay? But yeah, it's related to that aspect. If you want, it's related to the aspect that it seems that a thermal state looks a lot like the operator that would generate translation with respect to some imaginary time. Which is not an isometry, but the tough life. Whatever. So yeah, physical interpretation requires waving hands. That's the problem. We need to introduce a lot of things that don't... But then again, it makes our minds feel easier, though. Huh? Because we have a way to picture it. Even though mathematically it's like, what? But yes. Yes.
I guess what I'm asking, is there any way of understanding why this is only true for thermal state?
I mean, a posteriori, like most times, you can think, yeah, letting something thermalize is letting something like evolve to a stationary state that somehow the state now is correlated with the state in the future in a particular way. And that particular way has to do with the fact that because we impose thermality, the only, I'm going to go mathematical again, I'm sorry. The only analytical continuation that you have of the two-point correlator has periodicity in the complex plane. Yeah, I'm sorry. Every time I try to give a physical intuition, I feel bad and then go retreat. Yeah.
It's also related to something like losing information about microstate states too, because if you reach some thermal state, you have correlations into the future, but you're also assuming something about the correlations of the past, which aren't necessarily true if you're reaching a thermal state.
Yeah, but it's true, and that's very nice intuition, but it's a bit cheating, because if I know the time evolution, the unitary, the Hamiltonian, then I have all that information already. So it's not that I lose much.
Well, I think it's the thermal state is going to be the limit of some evolution. Like you evolve into a thermal state, but that's going to be, it's not going to be.
We haven't talked yet about thermalization, and that's the whole universe. Okay? So for now, we are doing just a nice property of thermal states. Now, what is super nice about this property? Oh, I was saying that it's almost one to one. For all purposes, it's a one to one thing. I can give you references to begin with, all KMS states are passive. All thermal states are passive. You know what passive means? It's a thermodynamics term. It means that you cannot extract work from them. Okay? You cannot extract work from a thermal state. So if you compute the expectation of energy before and after doing a process, you're always going to have to pay or stay the same. You're not going to get energy back on average. That is called passivity. And thermal states are passive. All thermal states are passive. All KMS states are passive. First, interesting observation. All KMS states are Gibbs states. Not all Gibbs states are KMS. It's rare, but you can have, you know, we talked about, sometimes you cannot define Gibbs states, but sometimes you cannot define the KMS condition and still define Gibbs states. In those cases, that are super funny. Then it's not one-to-one because of that. But other than that, to all effects, KMS states are Gibbs states. Are thermal states. When Gibbs states are well defined. And the nice thing is that this survives the limit of a continuum of dimensions. This thing you can define in a quantum field too. This thing you can define no problem in any system, the two-point correlator. So a notion of thermality, of the best notion of thermality that we have for quantum fields is let's demand that the field satisfies the KMS condition with a KMS temperature 1 over beta. And we call that temperature. And that's the best we can do. There's no other way to define thermal states of quantum fields. Well, there might be other ways, for sure. There's no Gibbs way to define field states. That's why many times when people try to do things with entropies in quantum fields, they kind of assume a finite number of degrees of freedom. Otherwise, Gibbs states are just doomed. They don't exist. They're not well defined. The partition function diverges. All right? So, KMS condition. Defines thermality in QFT. Now, the two, yeah.
So, if you do like a Lorentz transformation, you also get, like, you could also get, it has to do with like space like correlations.
No, it's gonna be. So,
correlations, but like with different spatial
forms. Yes, yes, for sure. But then again, we will see that. When we go relativistic, to define a KMS condition, we need to define a time-like vector. So we say KMS with respect to a time-like vector.
Okay. So the notion of KMS is not a covariant?
No. No. Yeah. In the sense, that is a tricky question always. It is covariant, but it's not covariant in the sense that it's not invariant, meaning that it's not the same. So a state that KMS for me may not be KMS for you. And that's what's behind the under effect.
Okay.
So a state that is KMS with respect to some partial tau may not be KMS with respect to partial t, but we are taking steps in the future already. So being acausal in a way.
Wait, that's actually not the question I was going to ask, but it was really interesting. So I was going to ask if you can start to look at space-like regions and start talking about KMS, or pardon me, if you stick to time-like regions and talk about KMS between different correlations, but with different, let's say, spatial coordinates, can you switch to like space-like correlations? And, like,
not for thermality. We're going to associate KMS with observers. So an observer will see a KMS state. And an observer has to be time-like, unless it's a time traveler. Anyway, so we're going to use the KMS condition to define thermality in QFT. Is when the Gibbs states are well-defined, it's equivalent. When they're not well-defined, it's the best we have. Okay. In fact, it's been argued, and all the literature in the KMS condition argue that this is the real thermality and not that one. That we can talk about that, but that's kind of cool. This generalizes the notion of thermality, and those cases that are Gibbs thermal but not KMS thermal are just not thermal. You can take whatever stance you want. There are, like, even first principles that people argue. I'm not going to get there. That's a rabbit hole. But just so you know, and I can give you some references if you want to read about it. There are books about it. There are books. Have you ever seen books on what is called thermal quantum field theory? It's algebraic approaches to quantum field theory from that are called thermal. It's about all this. Anyway, so yeah.
So KMS states are Poincaré invariant, right?
Are what, sorry?
Poincaré invariant?
KM states are Poincaré, no.
No?
No, they're translational invariant. We assume stationarity with respect to some time.
So how can I tell if my state is thermalized? Like
only with observer. Remember what I answered to Allison.
Yeah, yeah.
An observer is the one that defines KMS. It's KMS with respect to me.
Yeah, but I mean, like, if I have a system, then I expect that when I wait for long enough times, it will thermalize, right?
Maybe that won't happen. That thermalization is tricky. I keep telling you, let's wait. To answer those questions, there will be better answer when I define KMS and fields, when I write KMS and fields. Huh? Because we're going to find a thermal state can be KMS for some observer. Thermal state for a Minkowskian observer may not be KMS for a different observer, indeed.
That's what I mean. Like, it's just, but is it like within only Lorentz transformations?
It depends on your theory. Because this is general. If the theory is Poincaré invariant, yes. OK. Anyway, but again, people modify the theories to make the non-Poincaré invariant. We will talk a bit about that too, to do quantum gravity and things like that. Anyway, so this is all general. That's why let's wait until we actually particularize, and then we ask those questions, OK? Good. But I'm so happy that you like this, as in, like, you ask many questions and are a bit outraged by it or puzzled by it, which is good. That's the right thing. All right, so the two-point correlator in quantum fields, do I need this? The two-point correlator in quantum fields has a name, right? We gave it a name. It's written here. The expectation of the field evaluated. And here's where we enter. Imagine that I have an observer describing a trajectory x of t from some lab frame, OK? And then imagine that observer carries a detector. Remember that? So if the observer carries a detector, remember we saw that the detector that is smeared, right? Let's take the point-like limit of that detector, a very small detector. Okay? Point-like limit means that this mirroring function is a delta. Agreed? Everyone happy? If it's a delta, what it does is just this. Substitutes the xi for zero. So t of tau zero, x of tau zero, that is the trajectory of the center of mass of the atom. So let's call it tau of t of tau. T of tau and x of tau. This is basically the Hamiltonian becomes, for a point-like detector, the pullback of the field on the trajectory of the detector. So we have a, which is kind of intuitive. The detector sees the field along the points that it crosses. No? Very intuitive. Now, recall that the transition probability of a detector, if you remember, was proportional to something that we call the Wideman function. Remember that I evaluated copying from a paper of mine? Remember that? That I was like worried because I wrote a sign that was wrong and so on. That I call the Wideman function. That Wideman function is always quote, quote, because by the way, Wideman functions are distributions in general, not functions. Anyway, so the Wideman function was, I mean, we computed it for the vacuum. It was the vacuum expectation of the field in two positions, remember? Now, if we have a state, an arbitrary state rho, the Wideman function is still the expectation value. If you compute the transition probability on an arbitrary state of the field, you still get the Wideman function for that state. Okay, that thing. This thing is the Wideman function is the field point correlator. So someone carrying a detector will see the Wideman function evaluated on the trajectory of the detector. And now we're going to do something that is not often done in detector physics, like when people do detector stuff, because it's considered, I think, too simple. But I think it's really illustrative. Am I getting people lost? Because I changed a little bit gears, and I'm talking about detectors now. But it's just to let you know that in a quantum field, this is definitely one of those. This is a particular case of one of those. We take the observable amplitude of the field, and we evaluated the two-point correlator in two points on the trajectory of a detector. And the integral over that, if you remember, is what gives you the transition probability of the detector. Okay. So we define, so to define a Gibbs state, KMS states in QFT. Ingredients. You need a Hamiltonian. Well, I guess before a Hamiltonian, you need a time-like vector. Okay, you need a time-like vector. You need a Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian that's generated by this time-like vector. You need a Hamiltonian. And you also need a field state. Okay. So, a KMS, so let me just do it. Rho is a KMS state of temperature, of KMS temperature. TKMS, 1 over beta. With respect to that time-like vector. So if you want an observer that has that as a proper, as a for velocity, if and only if it is stationary and the Wideman function, tau prime, on the state, which is, of course, because stationarity, the Wideman function on delta tau, it only depends on t minus t and tau minus tau prime because of stationarity, it's equal to And this is stationarity. Yeah, so you remember. Okay, now if we do W rho of delta tau plus I beta, I get the complex antiperiodicity. Ah, that's the way. When I'm not looking for it, is when I say it. All right, so this is minus delta tau. Okay, and that's the definition. This thing is the definition of a KM state. And we say that rho is a KM state with respect to partial tau of temperature 1 over beta. Questions about that? Yeah.
If the time-like vector generates the translations in T, doesn't that mean it's...
No, in tau. Partial tau generates translation in tau. Right? Okay. So, of course, and this kind of may answer your question a little bit, is, different observers would define different KM states. Because KM states are only defined and referred to at time evolution. Okay? Yeah, your theory is covariant, so what would you expect? The observations that involve periodicity in time are observer dependent. Now, you have extra symmetries. It may happen that there's some translation between the states, but in general, there won't be. All right, so the time I have, not sure if I have time for this. How much time is reasonable? Yes to no.
They should have a break before the next lecture, which starts at 4:15.
Ah, well, it's because the weekend is in the way, and that's sad. I don't know what to do. Maybe I can start, but then it's worse if I start, no?
You want to come to the tutorial, or you can't come to the tutorial?
No, I'll come to it today. No. Okay, I will not do it. So the next thing that I want to do is to show you that if, so there's one thing. Okay, there are several ingredients that what we're going to do. Let me summarize. We're going to play a little bit with the response of a detector, and we're going to show that the response of a detector, if the switching function is regular enough, in the limit, when the detector time switching on goes to infinity, is actually the Weinmann function Fourier transform. So that's kind of cool. So if you have a detector, so how can you prove the Weinmann function? One way, if you want, get a detector and switch it on forever with a switching that is smooth. The response of the detector is directly the Fourier transform. If the state of the field is stationary only, the response of the detector is going to be the Fourier transform of the Weinmann function. That's kind of super cool. And what does that mean? Well, that means that the Fourier transform of the Weinmann function, if it's KMS, if the state is KMS, the Fourier transform will satisfy a property that under and you get this complex periodicity. When you Fourier transform this, you get this out as an exponential of beta, h. Of beta, an exponential of beta. And the nice thing about it is that we're going to use some algebra to show that the response of a detector on a KMS state is what we call a Planckian response. Okay, the response, the Weinmann function will be equal to the commutator times a Planckian response. Okay, and then based on that, we're going to show that we satisfy what is called detailed balance. Have you ever heard of detailed balance? That's what people often, most of the times, use as a notion of thermality. Detailed balance is a consequence of KMS. For a detailed balance of a detector, who knows what detailed balance is, just to know. How many people know? I want to see it. Okay, not many. Detailed balance is basically the difference between the excitation probability and the excitation probability. It's given by a Boltzmann factor. If you want, the populations are Boltzmannian kind of thing. That is, we will define it properly. That is called detailed balance condition. Detailed balance on a detector is a direct consequence of the detector being coupled to a thermal state with respect to the proper time of the detector. So we will find that detectors coupled to KMS states have thermal responses in the sense that we have detailed balance. And the last bit that I don't think, because of time, I will actually do, but maybe in the tutorial we can do that, is in a book that I will give you, a book. It's a paper of 200 pages by Takagi called Vacuum Noise and something else that I keep forgetting, Progress of Theoretical Physics. The journal is Progress of Theoretical Physics. Here is 1984. So in that paper, with full detail, it's shown that the Weidman function associated with partial t, tau, of an accelerated detector, so the x partial t minus t partial x, that's the partial tau of a detector with of someone with constant, that's the for velocity of someone with constant acceleration. That's the vector that generates a hyperbola when you exponentiate it. When you evaluate the vacuum states for an observer, a Minkowski observer, from, so the same state, look here, the vacuum state is KMS with two different times with different temperature. So the vacuum state is KMS of zero temperature for partial T, is the absolute zero state, okay? We will see that, or we will discuss, that it is also a KMS state for partial tau associated with the partial tau that generates the hyperbola, the partial tau of an accelerated observer, the partial tau that takes derivative with respect to the proper time of an accelerated observer. The field state is also KMS, the vacuum state is KMS for that partial tau with a different temperature. And in particular, with a temperature that is proportional to the acceleration, with the Andrew temperature. So we will see, and that's the second derivation, that detectors that accelerate, if switched on long enough, will see will satisfy detailed balance with a temperature, which is the Andrew temperature. And that convinced everyone that the Andrew effect is real. Have we understood the steps? So the steps, I'm going to just summarize them without a lot of talking, is first, we're gonna see that the response of a detector for long times, and that's the long times that you wait for thermalization, the response of a detector for long times is proportional if the switching is smooth enough. That's the adiabaticity condition that you need to thermalize. If the switching is smooth enough, if you don't do crazy stuff, as in like kicking the system to put it in interaction, if the switching is smooth enough, then the response of the detector will be the Fourier transform of the Weidman. Because the Fourier transform of the Weidman has the property that has an exponential here when satisfies KMS condition because of the properties of the Fourier transform. We will see that that means that the difference between the ratio between excitation probability and the excitation probability satisfies detailed balance. And in fact, the response of the detector is Planckian. And then finally, we will see how the vacuum state of the field, which happens to be KMS for the Minkowskian observer that has partial T as its for velocity, is KMS with zero temperature, is also KMS for the observer that has I'm not going to write it because I always mess up the signs, and I write the other one. So I'm not going to write it just because of that. But the one that has constant acceleration and the vacuum state of the field for a Minkowskian observer is also KMS for an observer of proper time tau that corresponds to a constantly accelerated observer. And it's KMS for that observer, but with a different temperature. And the temperature is going to be the Andrew temperature, proportional to the acceleration. So detectors, a detector in the ground state interacting forever with the vacuum state as seen by a Minkowskian observer will click, or they will click all right. It will click with a Planckian response, satisfying detailed balance. It will see a thermal state. It will get in thermal equilibrium with something. And that something is the vacuum. How is that? And the thermal equilibrium is at a finite temperature. That's what you get when you impose thermality on relativistic systems. You get funny things. All this thing about the notion of temperature being an absolute and characterizing equilibrium is a little bit observer dependent, like many things in relativity. So you can be a thermal equilibrium at a finite temperature with something that for someone else is an absolute zero. How is that? Oh, I don't know. It really gets me like, kind of thing that gets me excited. So that we will see, I guess, on Monday. This summary of things, but doing the calculations. We will do on Monday. And a quick comment, this will be exactly zero under a rotating wave kind of approximation. You won't get this. It will not thermalize. You won't get the Andrew effect. You will miss it if you do that. Even, you see, long times. So if the recipe you would apply is like, for long times it was OK to use rotating wave approximation, the answer is no. For long times, you have stationary inertial observers, yes. But if you have an accelerated observer, for long times, it's not a good approximation. Remember, the response of the detector under that approximation, if you start in the vacuum, is zero exactly. Okay? All right, I think that's it. I'll see you on Monday.